Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham and we are getting with the programme in association with Flowers Unlimited. Well then, the international breaks are now over until March and some of our stars are returning, knowing that we'll be going to the World Cup this summer. At the last World Cup, we had 8 Albion players representing their countries, including the eventual winner, Alexis McAllister. But can we beat that number next year? We now run a games without any international interruptions, starting this weekend with a visit of Brentford to the Amex. Our record against the Bees last season was pretty poor, including João Pedro's attempt and subsequent success at getting sent off and never playing for us again. And last time out against Paris, we recorded our second clean sheet in a row. Can we make it a hat-trick? Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back a man whose smiling face has been seen the world over, from coronations to World Cup finals, from the Vatican to the White House, and he now has a book out. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back the man who puts pro into programmes. It's the one and only Mr. Ian Hine. Hello, Hine.
Hello, chaps. How are you?
Yeah,
I'm
good.
I'm feeling artistic.
We do apologise. It's been far too long since you've last been on.
It has.
I think you've had a kind of a bit of an upheaval in life you've headed even further west, haven't you?
Yeah, I obviously been in Southampton for a long time.
Well, you started your life in Bognor, didn't you?
Yeah. Funnily enough, where I am now is probably closer to where I was born than Bognor. So I was born in Devon.
All right.
But when I was 3, my dad got a job at the Bognor Regis Teacher Training College. So we moved there, stayed in Bognor. And then I joined the bank, moved around a bit with them, and ended up settling in Southampton in 1989. So was there until 2 years ago when we decided, once all the kids had grown up, we'd move to Cornwall. So
was it to the kids growing up, or was it the fact you were living way too close to Guy Butters?
Both, I think. It was,
He loves you too.
Yes. He's that was an interesting chapter in my life.
There's all those KFC buckets in your garden. It was just too much for you.
Exactly.
Whereabouts in Cornwall are you then, mate?
We're in Wadebridge, close to Padstow on the north coast. So
I have been to that neck of the woods. I holidayed one time in Polzeath.
Lovely.
Our local
beach is Damer Bay, which is literally just around the corner from Polzeath. So
you've got a seriously good vineyard down there as well.
Yeah, Camel Valley.
Camel Valley.
I love the fact your local beach sounds like an actress from the 20s.
Well, yes, Damer Bay, dear boy. Yes.
No, I've had some Camel Valley wine before. I just seem to recall it tasted very much like Sancerre.
Yeah. I'm not a big wine buff, but we have done the Camel Valley tour.
Yeah.
It was good.
Yeah. It's got no apples
all
in
I'd
it,
say is
it?
How can you do a wine tour and know that it was good? If you remember it, you weren't there, surely.
Well, I was going to say, I knew it was good by the fact that I woke up the following morning feeling like death.
The problem is with these vineyards and stuff, they do tend to be out right in the middle of the sticks. And somebody
usually has to
drive to get
there. You don't grow grapes in the middle of the city,
there.
Do you?
No, this is true. But Camel Valley is probably 4 miles from where we are, so well in taxi range.
And actually, our good friends down at Ridgeview, of course, you can actually walk to their place from Burgess Hill to that.
Lovely. Well, we can walk to Camel Valley as well because it's right slap bang on the Camel Trail. But I think
are there camels?
One
don't
or
be
two.
Silly.
Yeah, don't be silly, AD.
Don't be silly, AD.
So we can. I think walking back might be a problem, but getting there, it's beautiful and
it's
lovely.
It's 4 miles there and about 12 miles back, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's no more
Guy Butters' house.
There's no more camels in Cornwall than there are eagles in Croydon, AD.
Well, we are our own gestalt animal, aren't we? We're an alpaca, but
No, but did how long have you thought of that one?
Oh, years. I just
Oh,
never
okay.
admitted it.
Nice. You
Very good.
finally
I
had
like
you
that.
finally found a use for it. Well done.
I like that. Yeah, I'm obviously feeling quite silly today. Okay, well, Heine, obviously, it's been a while since you've been on, so
Yep.
just to like retrace our steps, why don't you tell us about your Albion supporting history and how you fell in love with this great club of ours?
Okay. Well, it is actually quite an interesting story because, as I say, going by the old mantra of you support the team closest to where you were born, it would be Torquay United. But growing up in Bognor, my dad was a big rugby man, but he recognised in me that I had got more of a liking, although I did play rugby in my teenage years, I got more of a liking for the round ball game. So he used to kind of feed that, and like most kids in the 60s, I'd buy Charles Buchan's Football Monthly, Goal magazine, Shoot magazine, all this kind of stuff, and I had this amazing kind of thirst for the game as opposed to a particular club. But on my ninth birthday, so August 1968, my godfather, whose brother played for Torquay United, he came to our house and said, "Oh, Robin's playing for Torquay at Brighton in a couple of days. Do you fancy it?" So me, my godfather, my dad, and my best friend from primary school hopped in the car, went along, Brighton v Torquay, 28th of August 1968, and that was the day. And I mean, it all sounds very kind of corny, but it really is a vivid memory of mine.
Yeah. I have to ask a question though, Heine. Did you get a program?
Funnily enough, I did, and I've still got it. Still got the actual program from that first game. So,
I mean that must be, well, we're going to talk about programs in a bit, but I mean when you get that out now, because I mean we're talking about like pictures from certain times and adverts and things like that, and you pick it up and you look at it. I mean, it will take you right back to that day.
It absolutely does, and I think, I can picture in my head walking up because the tickets we got were provided by a player. They were comps, so they were in the West Stand, and I mean, everyone's memory of the West Stand at the Gold Stand is a bit hazy now, but it was these funny kind of rickety wooden steps, and you go up, but suddenly your head goes above the level of the top of the steps, and you see this amazing
Yeah.
green, because it was right at the start of the season. You see this green pitch lit by the floodlights, which by today's standards would be like five or six candles at each corner of the ground. But back then, to the 9-year-old me, it was this unbelievable theatre of football, and I just loved it. And that's when I fell in love with the game. And John Templeman scored Albion's goal that day, which was amazing because he lived quite close to where we lived in Bognor. He's from
Of course.
Yapton, so
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
and he was a big supporter of youth football and football in general in Bognor. And there's loads of photos around of him coming down to, present awards at football tournaments and Sunday league presentations and all this. He was amazing. So, he was the scorer of my first Albion goal, and it was that day where my love affair with the Albion started, and also my love affair with programs, and it just kind of snowballed from there, really.
I'm pretty sure, Al, that the show that when we had John Templeman on is probably in our archives somewhere. I think it's on the website.
Oh, crikey! I know we've had him on two or three times. I'm sure there must be something thereabouts. I've got to be honest with you. I don't think he mentions Heine in the crowd though, that particular day.
Well, he was.
Well, if he mentioned some irritating snotty nosed kid from a summer football tournament in Bognor, then that might narrow it down a bit.
Dad, why does that man look like Shirley Temple?
Exactly.
So, who from that particular game, Heine? I don't know if it's a case that you've looked it up since, or if you know it from memory. Obviously, I have to look it up because, sorry, mate, it's before I was born. Can you
Thanks.
remember the team that day?
Not really. Obviously, I know John Templeman
Yep.
played, but I would imagine, was it a bit? soon for Kit Napier that he might have played? I'm not sure. You're going to enlighten me.
Grummet, would he
Bosnages.
even
So
go?
I've got no, I've
No.
got I, someone I'm not
Probably
100%
Brian
sure
Pownie
of
in
because it
goal.
wasn't Pownie, it was someone called Burns.
Oh, right. Blimey.
Okay, so number two was Stuart Henderson.
Yep.
Then it's Everett at three. Is this ring a bell to you?
The name rings a bell, but
Yeah,
not.
number four was Templeman.
Yeah.
Five was John Napier.
Yeah.
Six, sorry, I've got to do. I'll tell you what. Tim Carter's book is not for people with older
No.
than 45. Dave Turner at six.
Yeah.
Howard Wilkinson at seven.
Yeah.
We've got Nobby Lawton at eight.
Yeah.
Kit Napier at nine. Charlie Livesey 10, and Paul Flood 11.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, so a lot of players who, I mean, Kit and John Napier, extraordinarily not related. And Charlie Livesey was a great player, but it was a few years after that before I started going regularly. Because obviously I was only 9, and Dad wasn't around every week to take me, but yeah,
I
it
mean,
was.
were you close enough to say Bognor Station? That very quickly, that was your method of getting there, or did you have another
Well,
method?
it certainly was when I moved into my teenage years, because going to school in Bognor, you tended to be either Pompey or Brighton, because
Right on
Bognor's,
the cusp, isn't it?
yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's pretty, I don't know, it must be fairly close to being exactly equidistant between the two. And I actually went to quite a few games at Fratton Park, because,
Good.
well, yeah,
And we're
I
still
always,
talking to you.
sorry.
And we're still
Well, you
talking to you.
exactly, but I did see the light. Oh, I did see the light.
Oh,
So,
good lad.
but it was really only in the I guess I went quite a lot with my mates from school in 72, 73, until I fell foul of the British Transport Police, but that's another story. And my parents clamped down, but yeah, sort of mid-70s, and then obviously we went into the golden years of Albion supporting in many respects from 75 through to 79. And then I started playing football on Saturdays, so it meant I stopped going to, on the Seagull special and everything, which again, those great years at the end of the 70s were just amazing times to be an Albion
Could you
fan.
explain to our one listener who's below the age of 35 what a seagull special is?
Okay, so in the mid 70s, I think probably 75, maybe the beginning of 76, the club decided in their wisdom to lay on football charter trains, which were a big thing back in the 70s. And it became known as the Seagull Special. There was actually a metal plaque that used to go on the front of the train. I mean, it was on display at the museum that was at Falmer. So for me, it was up at God knows what time in the morning to get the train from Bognor to Barnum, Barnum to Brighton, and then pick up the train, which trundled across the country to all manner of far-flung places like Oldham, Blackburn. But again, great, great days. I mean, there was a group of us who used to go, and it was fantastic.
It was because it was just literally one train, and they used to
Yeah.
like have to keep changing directions at Spurs and stuff to, and not in as in Tottenham, as in the railway Spurs,
Yeah.
but to get and
Yeah.
turn tables and whatever to get in the whatever
And
direction
getting
it
a
needs to go.
absolute, yeah, exactly that. And getting across London was always a problem. I mean, now London has got this unbelievable network of suburban railways, but back in those days, the line, it was usually we veered off at Clapham Junction and then went through past the back of Chelsea's ground, funnily enough, and then up to kind of, I don't know, Willesden Junction, somewhere like that. But back in those days, that line wasn't as well used as it is now. So you'd be trundling along at sort of 3 or 4 miles an hour. If you happened to get stuck in a siding and another football special pulled up next to you, then it could sometimes get a bit lively and being
Yes.
escorted from the ground at the other end. I
Because the
remember
other thing about trains in those days is that you could open the door yourself.
yeah, exactly that, and open the
Yeah.
window down and
Yeah. Absolutely.
yell
So
out.
were you on the probably the single most famous Seagull special journey back from Newcastle?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and no, I wasn't, because that particular season was my one season of playing rugby on a regular basis.
Oh,
So
you pick them, don't you?
I know I was playing for Bognor Seconds on that day at Haywards Heath away, and I remember coming back and getting the news from Newcastle. So I would absolutely love to say I was on that train, but I wasn't.
I can
But
even go so far as to say, and I can't remember who told us the story. I might have been even been Mark Lawrenson on this show. Was that Jerry on the train is obviously coming back, and the players are all mingling amongst the fans. And Jerry Ryan's worried that because his wife's waiting for him at Haywards Heath station, because by now it's 1:30 in the morning,
yeah.
and with that the train just goes flying through the station. And his wife's just on the platform going, "What on earth is going on
Yeah.
here?"
And all the players were steaming by that time.
Yeah, they absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was
Yes,
something else
I
beginning
was.
with S as well, but let's not go
Well,
down
I
that
was.
road either. So you were saying earlier, just now, Heine, about in your early days of being a sort of preteen,
Yeah.
that you buy all the magazines and the Charles Buchan book and things like that.
Yeah.
And obviously, but then come mid 68, you go to your first game. Do you think that that was kind of a precursor to you getting the programmes? You just had this thirst for all things football, or was there something sort of more intrinsically ethereal about having the printed word?
It was definitely the precursor. I think every kid. I mean, I was born in the late 1950s, very
It
late
doesn't
19.
show, Heine.
Well,
It doesn't show.
you're very kind. But I think every kid born around about that time had some kind of collecting gene in them, and for me, it started off, I just loved the game. So it was just, I was like a sponge for knowledge and information on the game. So things like Charles Buchan's Football Monthly Goal magazine, which launched, I think, in 1968. So the first time that came out was around about the time. I mean, I can remember not necessarily supporting the team that won the FA Cup for a year until the next one came along, but it was kind of that. So in the 60s, I think people generally were much more in love with the game. I think football is now much more tribal, and you can speak to Man United fans who have got no idea about the history of Liverpool, because Liverpool are their greatest rivals and they just don't care about them. Whereas
Wouldn't
I think,
necessarily say that per se. I mean, there are obviously diehard, and obviously back in the 60s and 70s, it was a little bit more tasty, for want of a better phrase. And so, I mean, thankfully, that's largely died out now.
I think of it in terms of as a work colleague you used to have. Now, he was a fair bit older than me. I'm not sure, I'm sure if he's still alive. So I'm talking about 30 years ago, I had the conversation with him. But when he was growing up, when he was a lad of about 20, was about the time of the Munich air crash. So Manchester United players all losing their lives. But and that's when he said that after that, that Manchester United became the bigger club in Manchester because of more inherent sympathy. But prior to that, people in Manchester would go to Main Road and Old Trafford alternate weeks, depends on who was at home, obviously. Yes, there was a sort of a preference for Man United or a preference for Man City if you were there, but not to the point of as the word you've used, Ian, tribalism, to that a United fan would have nothing to do with a City fan. They'd actually go to a game, and like I say, they're into the
I
football
think there
per
was a lot.
se.
There was a lot more football tourism then as well, because basically it was you could just turn up at any ground in the country on a Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and you could get
Absolutely.
to see George Best, or you could get to see like
Definitely.
Alan Mullery or Bobby Moore or any one of these heroes. These
Yes. And it was the love of the game that sucked me in, certainly. which then kind of crystallized into a love for a club at that particular time in 1968. But yeah, I mean, I was just like an absolute sponge. And the other, sorry, just going back
No,
to
you
your
carry on, mate.
now about what kind of developed the program side of things in that seasons, it was like the second or third season. Albion used to have this wonderful little magazine included with the program called the Football League Review. It was like a program-sized magazine. It was the brainchild of this journalist in Leicester who felt that it would be good to have a little magazine covering the whole of the Football League, all the 92 clubs. And he launched this thing in 1965. It ran until January 1975. And that was in Albion's programme. So you'd have the 16 pages of the programme, but stapled in the middle was another 16 pages of the Football League Review, which had, you were just as likely to see an article on the club shop at Rochdale as you were Man United or Liverpool or Man City. So it was, and what that also did was prompt it, as the popularity of the Football League Review kind of waned in the 70s, it prompted program editors to be a bit more creative with their own magazines, because I think in the from the golden ages of the early 50s, when certainly Albion programs were absolutely fantastic, everything got a bit stale in the 60s, and it needed a kick up the backside, if you like, and that was brought in by program editors moving on from the Football League Review.
But then, actually, what you raise there, I mean, what you're saying there, kind of makes me realize another sort of historical context here is the nature of the relationship between a football club and its supporters. Now, once upon a time, I mean, when you consider how it is now, I mean, it's absolutely vital when and people do get very, very upset when the club doesn't do this or doesn't do that, or when their club has said this or and it goes against their thing. Whereas once upon a time, and I can remember going to the Goldstone in the 80s and 90s, where you just turn up, watch the game, moan, cheer, celebrate, grizzle, as and then you left, because there was this invisible brick wall between the club, the hierarchy, and the supporters. And it sounds like what you're talking about there is that, like you say, even on the most fundamental level of something that I take for granted, which is the match program, that, like you say, some more effort had to be put into it. So, in order to keep those fans loyal, they had to, the clubs had to sort of pull their socks up and make those people become returning customers. I mean, I don't like the phrase when people say, "Oh, your fans, not customers," and that drives me round the twist as to the accusation that's leveled at Paul Barber, because that's a nonsense. But I mean, it's even things like when replica shirts started being sold in the, I suppose, the late 70s, early 80s, and even then, some clubs took a long time to cotton on, if you excuse the fabric pun, to cotton on to that.
Not many of them were
Vicos on.
cotton. That Albion shirt in the late 70s was made of barbed wire.
It was. But do you
How
see? But do you see
utter
where the
nonsense.
program itself is kind of an? It's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy of, not only is it keeping the supporters up to date with what the club is doing, because there is that thirst in for people to know what the club is doing.
Well, yes, I think for me, the program is not just a record of the game, it's a snapshot of life in Brighton or wherever the club happens to be at that moment in time. So as such, as a historian of sorts, they are important historical artifacts. And I think going back to that period in the 60s and 70s, in the same way that people were beginning to clamour for more colour, more interest, the one of the sections in the book is the player profile, and that came about as a result of this kind of
It's like a
fever.
thirst, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And when Shoot started doing their player profiles, people wanted to know what George Best, well,
Steak and chips. Luffa van Dros.
Well, actually, I mean,
Exactly.
I'm not sure which way around to do this from here on in, because we're 25 minutes in as to whether
Yeah,
to talk
sure.
about this aspect of it or
Yep.
to bring in the book. But there
Yeah.
is one. But we're talking about programs here, and
Yep.
Aidy and myself have had a damn good laugh about this over the years. Is knowing full well, especially when we've had players on from yesteryear, and we say, "Oh, do you
Yeah.
realise you said this in your player profile?" And he said, "Well, I don't feel that at all." Knowing full well that these player profiles were completely and utterly fabricated.
Yeah.
And let's not actually bring up a racial divide here, but there was, the
Phil
culture back
Collins.
time was, if it was a black player, their favourite singers were Luther Vandross and Diana Ross, and if it was a white player, then they liked Phil Collins and Dire Straits.
Yeah, fair.
And there's a thirst for knowledge, and then there's the sort of like being sold a pup, isn't there?
Yeah.
There is, but also I think as the kind of craze for that developed, the players themselves started thinking, well, we're going to have a bit of fun with this. And I think it was Steve Foster who, when asked what his biggest dislike was, he's like opening bills and answers like that. And oh God, who was it? One of the lads in the 80s, it was what are your hobbies? And it's like too private to mention. And my particular favourite is from 1987, the Seagull file, which was absolutely magnificent. They went back to the original format, favourite colour, car,
Yeah.
favourite holiday destination. And Gary Nelson was asked, what's your pre-match meal? Expecting, I don't know, muesli and energy drink and what have you.
Boiled chicken.
Beef curry. And of course, everyone's, oh my God, amazing. And found out in years to come that that was actually him having a bit of a laugh at the expense of the person asking the questions.
Yeah.
But
Well, I mean, I have to say, Heine, because obviously, myself and Al have been doing the show a very long time now.
yeah.
We're coming up to 18 years. We're over 18 years. But, and quite often we've had players on who played for the Albion before the internet existed.
Yeah.
And so doing research for them, your love of programs and your what the your website, the way you're this labor of love of yours,
Oh.
that started like 2012, I think you
I
started doing it,
think
wasn't it?
the website was launched in 2012
Yeah,
for
so
3 years.
it's like, this
Yeah.
thing, I've have to go through it religiously, and finding things out, like when the player made his debut, who was playing at the Brighton Centre, because you'd always have the Brighton Centre adverts in there,
Yeah.
and then you find out how much the tickets were and you'd cry,
Yeah.
and it's, and seeing like the things like the pen pics and the
Yeah.
those articles
It's
and looking at the
fantastic.
team sheets and who was
Yeah.
playing and what
And
and who they're taming.
wasn't Ron Pavey interesting?
Well, that's another great thing about it, that Albion, they've always been a club that's kind of looked maybe beyond the what you would expect. And in the 70s and 80s, all the different variations of the player profile, they talked to the Ron Paveys of this world and the secretaries in the office and what have you. And it's just they're just great historical artifacts, and
Yeah,
I just love them, as you know. So
there was a brilliant one with Frank Worthington in there, and my God, what was he wearing? It was in his full on Elvis regalia. Oh,
he
hilarious!
was completely obsessed with Elvis Presley, to
Yeah.
be fair. So
Okay, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. And that's it, as I said at the show, we are getting with the program in association with Flowers Unlimited, Alan.
yes, Flowers Unlimited, a
So,
company which incidentally does actually advertise in the match day program as part of their sponsorship. So, Heine's great great grandchildren can then look back on the 250th anniversary of the Albion and see, you know, this particular current advertisement, set of advertisements in there. But for whatever your reason for sending flowers or gifts, we can help, say Flowers Unlimited. If it's a birthday, anniversary, birth, celebration, thank you, sympathy, sorry, or anything else, we have the answer. If it's a wedding or a corporate event, our team will come up with something to wow you. If it's a funeral, we can guide you in choosing a tribute that really reflects the life of your loved one. Trust us to provide the service and quality that you really deserve. So go to flowersunlimitedbrighton.co.uk or go to 175 to 177 Portland Road, Hove. Or you can even phone them up if you feel like it. 01273, yes, that is still a thing, 796-000, as opposed to calling the Seagull line on 8049. That was an advertisement from
right in 8049.
Well.
Yeah, Tony Millard.
Indeed. But if you
were to ring that number, Al, if you were to ring that number and you just happened to mention that you were a Brighton season ticket holder, what would happen?
I think you kind of have to ask it because they'll say, well, so what? It's yes, you can get 20% off. But thanks very much indeed to Dave Costa of Flowers Unlimited for supporting the Albion Roar the way he does. Indeed, now then, Heine.
Yes.
Heine, what have you been doing for the last 400 years now? Because that's how long this book feels as though it has been put together. I think probably being a program collector of many years passing, something had to give and you've stuck it all in one book. So on your marks, get set, go.
Right. Okay. Well, as an aside or in parallel with the development of the website, which, as I say, that started in 2009. I had this, well, looking back now, utterly deranged idea that it would be a good idea to have a digital record of all my Albion home programs. So I thought, right, I'll scan every page of every program that I own.
Now, I remember this because the last time you were on, you said, well, what happened was my wife bought me a scanner and I didn't know what to do with it.
Something like that. Yeah, exactly. And so as this process went on, it kind of sparked something in me on the writing side of things, thinking, well, it would be great to write a book on the history of the program because they've got so much to give on the historical side of things. So I guess around about the time that the website was launched in 2012, I started jotting down odd chapter plans and, you know, what would the book look like and writing notes and what have you. And I've got notebooks here and odd bits of paper and my trusty digital notebook as well with like loads of just jottings written down. And it started to take shape properly during COVID when obviously like most of us had a lot more time on my hands. But it was only when Justine and I moved down to Cornwall that it actually freed up the proper time that I needed to actually put some sort of order into it. So I started writing it properly, I would say, in maybe October 2023. So just under 2 years after that, I got to the end of it. I realised very early on that people didn't want maybe just the straightforward chronology of the program, you know, like, well, in 1972, the cover was light blue with a cartoon, blah, blah, blah. In 74, it was this, that, and the other. You need to break that up a little bit. And so that I then developed the extra sections on how the players are looked at, how the manager's notes have evolved over the years, which is very interesting in itself. And in particular, the way the kind of rise and fall of the program in tandem with the fall and rise of the club and how programs of the 90s, for example, gradually got worse and worse and worse because of the breakdown in the relationship between the club and the market for those programs. And then as an aside to that, how everything developed in the noughties with the fight for Falmer and the program was such a vital part of that process because the program was used as the conduit for much of the information that the club wanted to get out. You know, I'm sure we all remember Ed Basford's microscopic print notes in
Indeed.
the programs from every single day of the planning
Yeah.
inquiries. And it wasn't just that, but it was, we need to get people to come to these marches, and what better way to than to use that
Yeah.
program?
Because it's very difficult, it's very hard, easy, well, very easy to forget that at that particular time, and actually throughout the existence of any football program, really, up until probably the current day, because it was a way of communicating directly with the fans, because there was no social media, there was no internet, and this was, apart from like the Argus and the rest of the newspapers, that was
And
the
the
only
Seagull
way.
line.
It's the Seagull line on Brighton 8049. I've got some very exciting news about a transfer, but first, the reserves lost at Oxford. Yes,
That is the worst Tony Millard impression I've ever heard.
Diabolical. Well, you don't want me to do a good one. But it was a way of communicating and getting that message across. And and I think because of the way that things were going with the club as well, and we were short of money at that particular moment in time, anything anyone could actually do to help boost any and the revenue. So I think the program probably was at an all-time high in terms of sales at that point.
Can I just cut in on that one, actually, Adrian? I mean, I'm just thinking here of that particular time. Let's say that decade between 95 and 05. There's two things here. There's that probably within the space of no more than 3 or 4 years, the program as an entity was being used as a force for good and a force for nefarious activity by both aspects of the club. Now, we'll remember back to when sometime 95, 96, when David Bellotti wrote program notes to say stop whining about things that aren't happening. And of course, I seem to recall it was a game against Notts County. I remember reading it sort of on the North Stand, waiting for the game to start, and that really galvanized all the fans. And then, like I say, as Adie's pointing out, 5 years, 5, 6 years later, then we're needing it as a news bureau to find out what's happening with the well, moving back to Wisden, obviously, then there's the stadium and things like that. But also, I think that the program was in its heyday, which was bolstered rather than competed with, even though I think we felt it was competition at the time, with the fledgling fanzine movement.
The Scars and Stripes
All
and
those kinds of
Cut&Dry
things.
and
And Heine, you do touch on on the Albion fanzines as well with this. I mean, there's no stone left unturned on this. And I'm just curious as to whether you felt that I suppose we're looking back on it with a historical context of 30 years, of whether the program and therefore the club, even though it didn't, needed to pull its socks up because of the fanzine movement.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, I mean, certainly that period from August 1995 onwards, when the news first broke of what was going on off the pitch. And I think the fanzine, I mean, this is one of the reasons why I wanted to include it in the book, because, as you say, the fanzine, in terms of an information exchange, the fanzine probably usurped the program as a means of supporters getting an up-to-date idea of exactly what was going on. I mean, you touched on Bellotti's crazed program notes in many cases, and certainly in that final season at the Goldstone, the club were, the fans were turning away from the program, and it was the fanzine that was, or the various fanzines that were around then. But I think the real genius and what really turned things round was when, obviously, Dick Knight came in and realised that probably his biggest task was to get the fans back on board. And what better way to do that was to make the programme better. And what better way to do that than to bring back some people who the or to introduce some people who the fans could relate to. So one of the first things he did in 97 was to bring back the ever-present Tony Millard to edit the programme. But he brought on a young lad as press officer, a chap called Paul Camillin,
Whatever happened
who,
to him?
yeah, exactly. Yeah, where's he now? But that, I mean, Paul's story completely exemplifies and personifies that turnaround in fortunes. You know, the program, rather than being the voice piece of the evil regime, it then became a microphone for what was now happening good in the club. And, you know, other prom, I mean, Scars and Stripes, a magnificent fanzine with people like Dan Tester at the heading. Dan ended up editing the program for a little while, and you know,
I
still
think we'll
contributes
put
now.
out a
So,
nod also, I think, for someone else who's working on the program was Roy Shooter,
absolutely,
not 3 years after lambasting Bellotti for an appalling letter that he got written from his solicitors.
one of the finest fanzine moments of all time, arguably. That copy of that letter with all of Roy's corrections is just a thing of
Absolutely.
absolute beauty.
I mean, the
And
point we're
Roy's, of
looking at.
course, Roy's stuff in the program, his pub guide to away trips was absolutely sensational
Sorry.
and
But what we're
and that
looking
that
at here,
was well
oh,
used.
yeah, that was another thing about the program in the noughties, the way that process of re-welcoming the fans back into the fold of the club through the eyes of the program was magnificently done, because they involved people like that. It got a bit light-hearted, you know, with the pub guides, and you know, the player profile got a bit kind of quirky in the late noughties with that kind of A to Z thing that Dan used to do. It was brilliant.
But this is what I'm obviously I've got a copy of the book, so I've got the advantage of doing this here is, I mean, just the last sort of 5, 10 minutes that we've just been talking about here, but also, going through the book itself, is that you realize the program is not just necessarily some printed paraphernalia that you have as part of your quote match day experience, that you realize that this is actually quite a political, and I use the word advisedly with a small p, it's quite a political document. Because the other thing I'm looking through with this is, and I'm on page 31, and there's a reason why I'm on page 31, and I'll tell AD in a minute, is that what you're looking at, certainly with the advertisements, but also I think necessary the language of the editorials in here, is that you see a fascinating social historical document, or set of documents, or a movement of documents. So
100%.
obviously the book starts in about 1896, and this predates the club, but we're looking at advertisements for places that are no longer there, or certainly businesses that are no longer there, although there's one or two that are still there, and probably advertisements for products that are now either you can't advertise or probably are illegal in the first place. So not only are you looking at the history of the program, or certainly of Brighton Hove Albion's programs, and by the way, brief interjection here, I've noticed that nearly all the way through this, at no point do or at every point the club either refer to themselves as Brighton and Hove Albion or Albion. Very, very rarely do they say just Brighton. Or relatively rarely do they say just Brighton. So when you're going through this and you're doing your research and all the collections that you've got here, obviously you're zooming in on the football aspect of this, Heine, but do you realise, did it occur to you that how much you're doing a very important social document?
Well, yes, I mean, it did occur to me, because the changing face of advertising is another thing that kind of prompted me to sit down and write the thing, because I absolutely love some of the advert, particularly from the 50s. I mean, you open the middle page of a program from the mid 50s, and not only have you got the advert for the local train excursions, but you can pop down to your local chemist and buy yourself a Brooks rupture appliance.
A what?
Exactly, rupture appliance, and all manner of stuff like that. But we've obviously seen a change from back in those days. All the adverts exclusively local. The football club is a very local thing, and now the advertising in the program is a reflection of the global nature of not only of the sport, and not only of the Premier League, but of Albion as well. So, you know,
I
you've
mean,
got to.
I've just opened a random program at random from 1955, actually, and there's an advert here. Fathers, you want good football. Your children want good footwear. Insist on John King sandals at your That's your shoe shop, King Street, Brighton.
Exactly. And stuff like, and Horn Brothers, the tailors, certain bit more prevalent in the pre-war programs in terms of their adverts. But you know, Fryco, the Portslade based soft drinks company, I think they ended up being taken over in years to come by Cadbury Schweppes. But you had all these local companies. And
Pamplins.
yeah,
Yeah. So
exactly.
Pamplins and the Hippodrome all
So
the
go
time.
Exactly. I've just found the advert for Brooks, actually.
Yeah.
So it's Brooks Rupture Appliances, supplied under the National Health Service. Personal fittings at Farmers, 30 Queen's Road, Brighton.
How on earth do you pick up the gig as a fitter for a rupture appliance? I mean,
It's not
something for
something.
your
It's something you keep
CV.
quiet off your CV, isn't
Well,
it?
absolutely,
And I'm
absolutely.
looking at things like, adverts for the Eclipse pub.
Yeah.
I think you've since said that there is. I don't know sort of deepest hove that well, but you said it's since changed its name. But I
Yeah.
was it wasn't relatively that long ago, was it?
No. And I mean, the Eclipse is obviously writ large in Albion history. I mean, the Heritage Society, we used to have our meetings at the in the room at the above the Eclipse.
Oh,
So
right, got you. Yeah. Now,
that's
there's a reason why I mentioned page 31 here. Now, obviously, you're going to remember because you've lived with this for the last, not just 2 years. So Ian writes, never was this more evident, and this is about the club trying to whip up some enthusiasm. Never was this more evident than the notes for the game on 30th of April 1958, when victory over Watford would mean promotion to Division Two for the first time in the club's history. Now, it's what the club wrote, and where do you think we got our name from?
I know you. I
For in the
know
thing it says, tonight is the night for the Albion Roar, and I am certain that supporters will, by their enthusiasm, prove their support for the boys by a resounding roar. So play a major part in giving the Albion promotion.
Well,
It will not be through a lack of encouragement from patrons if we unfortunately miss that coveted honour. I mean, what a, set yourself up for failure, Billy. So here's to a good, clean sporting. No, you want violence, really.
yeah,
So
that's
here's a
right.
good,
Yeah,
clean sporting and
kick him
entertaining
to
match.
death.
Well,
In this,
that would
the
be the
Albion.
game. You just need to change your name to Willie Thorne, and then we'll be that gestalt entity again.
I'm sure there's a gag there somewhere. So this is
Highly
Billy
got it.
Lane, the
Highly got
Albion.
it.
This is Billy Lane, the Albion manager, trying to whip up some enthusiasm. And of course, this was a game where probably a lot of people didn't pay to get in, and all the kids sat on the cinder track around the outside anyway.
Yeah.
Luckily, we won 6-0, but that's not my point. Yeah, I mean, that's so I just saw that, and I'm thinking, I'm sorry that we invaded your mind, during the book, Ian, but thanks for
It's
putting that in
no
there.
problem at all. I mean, and of course, the Goldstone Roar gave its name to a supporters club magazine in the 60s, of course.
Absolutely.
Yep. So, yes, it's
Yeah.
and I mean, something like that just demonstrates how important the fans are to the club, and vice versa, of course. And you know, the program is this entity that links the two on every single or every other week when you walk up to the Goldstone Priestfield with Dean and the Amex and buy your I mean, how good are this season's program covers, by the way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, they're a kind of a throwback to about 1970. But then you think, well, for a lot of people, well, except for you, it's in your lifetime. But sorry, it was 55 years ago. And if you then take 55 years ago back from 1970, you're into 1915, then you realize how long ago 55 years really was. Yeah, it's also the changing fashions as well. There are some shocking mullets in here.
Oh yeah,
Did you have a
atrocious.
mullet, Heine?
I did, well, not a mullet as such, but I did have hair that was probably
Buffon.
longer. Yeah, I
Now, the thing is, it was the time, it was the style, and what have
it
you.
was
So,
of the age, yes, indeed.
I mean no disrespect by this, but did you do this all on your own, or what help did you get, or what did you need to have happen? You think, I can't be doing with this.
Well, I have to say I did it all.
The whole lot. Even the editing and the typesetting.
Editing, typesetting, I did the whole lot. I wrote it all out. Well, a lot of it was written out longhand
Yeah.
initially because That's just me. That's the kind of weirdness of Heine, in that I mean, maybe it's an age thing, but I do like a bit of longhand. So wrote it out, and then part of the editing process was the transferring of the longhand into the typewritten. So it was all typed out in Word. I did all the typesetting, did all the importing of the images. I had a little bit of help at the end from the printers when you start getting into the, and you'll know this more than I do, Al, about the technicalities of the type of file
Yeah,
that makes it print
PDFs. They want
ready.
single page
Yeah, and
PDFs. Yeah.
the CMYK file format and all that nonsense. So I had a bit of help at the end from the printers, but I can genuinely say that I did everything. The cover was, I designed the cover. Justine gave a bit of input into the background color of the
No,
cover.
that's correct as well. Yeah. I've
No.
got to be honest with
But
you, as
not that
someone
she's
who's
an
been in,
artist or anything, Heidi.
well, exactly, yeah.
As
Yeah. What
someone
does
who's
she
been
know?
As someone who's been in publishing for 40 years, and I've worked on magazines and softback books and hardback books, I've never known such a major project be undertaken by one person. Now, the reason I say this, and I say I didn't mean disrespect by this, because this is a gargantuan piece of work. And under other circumstances, I think just plain sanity would insist that this is where you think, I'm struggling here. I'm going under here, but because there's so much going on, logic dictates this is a multi-person job. So if you're going to set to, if you say that this is yours and yours alone, I'm
Yeah.
utterly, utterly agog, because, like I say, in all my years in publishing, I've never known anything quite so monstrously huge be undertaken by one person. Now, obviously, I get that the whole labor of love bit, but to go from start to finish, I've got to congratulate you, Heine. It's
Oh,
this is a triumph and a
thank
masterpiece.
you. I really appreciate that. And as you say, you touched on what ended up being the real driver in those days of doubt, when I'm thinking, what the hell am I doing? I mean, am I ever going to get this over the line? It's that labor of love thing, and the fact that it's not only love of the football club, it's the love of the program as well. And you know, I hope that that comes through in the pages and the images of the book. But I mean, obviously I had days and weeks where I thought, no, I can't do this, but I can genuinely say that every single moment of it was a labor of love. I mean,
Yeah.
it is a cliche, but
So, Heine, I have to ask you, and it's a very stupid question, so
oh,
bear with
you're
me
good at
here.
these. Go on.
I know. So, when you first got your first test printing of the thing, and
Yeah.
you're holding it in your hands,
Yeah.
and you're seeing it, the physical copy of it for the first
Yeah.
time, how are you feeling?
I'm pretty emotional, to be perfectly honest. I have got a video of that moment. Justine recorded that. Maybe I'll share that with you on WhatsApp at some stage. But yeah, it was a very emotional moment, because it's basically 384 pages. So printing it out to look at was a little bit impractical, because it's a large format book as
Well, I
well.
say it's
So
not A4, is it?
no. So that provided various issues, and also it's not the same. So yeah, I actually had an alternative printer involved at the start, based in this country, and they said, oh, send us the file and we'll send you a proof version. So that's the version I got. I mean, it doesn't look, I mean, I know we're on the radio, but
Yeah, no, it's
it
not
doesn't look
video master.
massively
Well,
different, but there's
we
still,
are recording video here, so
yeah.
just make sure you get your underpants on.
Well, oh, who knows? I haven't stood up yet. So yeah, when I got that and opened it up, I mean, just will tell you, it was a big moment for me, because I've always loved writing, and as you know, I've been writing for the program itself since 2012. Ramming my love of programs down the throat of anyone who'd care to read it. But to actually take this on and then to see it come to fruition in that way, yeah, it was an amazing feeling. It really was.
Now, we can't congratulate you completely without there being one downside to this particular book.
Go on.
Where's the Heine art?
Yes, well, I think, yes, I, well, what can I say? I can only apologize for the horrendous lack of Heine
It
art.
is a serious omission, Heine.
Yeah, I
Now,
know.
can you,
It's
to our under 35-year-old listener, could you explain the concept of Heine art?
okay. So in 2004, Albion reached the playoff final, and much to my irritation, when we had the games against Swindon in the semi-final, and I knew, having looked at my diary, that we were going to be on holiday on the day of the final. So we were in Mallorca.
You're good at missing the big games, aren't you?
Oh, don't. So we were, and we found a bar. So there was myself, my eldest son Ben, and my father-in-law, who incidentally is Palace, or was Palace, he's passed away.
Ooh.
So we found this random bar in the sort of slight back streets of Mallorca, walked in full of Bristol City fans. So there was a bit of good-natured banter up until the penalty. Then they just basically turned their backs on us and just sort of sat there in silence till the final whistle. So at the final whistle, I think it was Ben, my son, said, "Oh, Dad, let me take a photo because I have my Albion shirt on." And for the benefit of the video, I
I'm so
was
glad we've managed to get a finally an updated Heine
that
art.
was genius.
there was a picture of me, arms spread wide, face joyful at the final whistle of this 1-0 victory, and that picture cropped up on one of the message boards, North Stand chat, as a just a you know a, an aside really, and then someone else decided to crop my head and the out of this and put it onto other pictures, and it kind of snowballed from there, really. I mean, some of the pictures were slightly more risque
Which
others,
guy?
but it's even though this started 21 years ago, I still get people sending me, it's usually Brett Mendoza, but whenever something momentous happens in the world, I get a notification on my phone or on Facebook, and it's like Brett who's superimposed my face on the entourage around Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, for example, is the
Oh,
latest one.
that
So
is low.
yeah, but yeah, Heine art is something that is crazy, but it is something that I'm really proud of.
It is one of my favorite things. There was, I think that I don't know how often the thread gets bounced on NSC these days, but
Well, it's in NSC Gold
is
now.
it? Oh, that's why I can't find it. But it's just like scrolling through that. If you're feeling ever so slightly down, just go and have a nose at that because it will lift your spirits immensely. It is just so
Well,
good.
thank you. And if you're friends with me on Facebook, I've got a Facebook album of all my Heine art pictures as well. So
Fantastic.
that's there. But yes, it's a crazy funny thing, but I love it. I absolutely love it.
Right, we are basically out of time now, Ian. So,
Oh.
the final thing, the plug. How much, when, how, who, how do you get a hold of a copy of this?
Okay, it's available to pre-order
Okay,
right
let's
now.
hang on, let me just first and foremost
Okay.
get the title right because we
Yeah.
haven't actually mentioned the title itself. It is
Brighton and Hove Albion, an illustrated history of the match day programme
okay,
by
so
me.
it
So price
actually says
30.
me here, actually. It doesn't say Ian Heine, it does say me on my book.
So it's 35 quid, and it's available to pre-order right now from my website, www.seagullsprograms.co.uk. The physical books aren't here yet, but as I say, they are steaming their way up the west coast of Africa as we speak. They are due to hit the shores of the UK right at the beginning of December. So I will do everything in my power to get them all out to people who buy them by Christmas. So, what better way to celebrate that special person in your life than buying them a copy of the book?
And
Even
giving
if
the
they don't
postman
like
a
the book.
hernia at the
Sorry,
same time.
just give us that website address again.
it's www.seagullsprograms.co.uk.
And I should point out, while you're there, have a good look around because it is such a wonderful website. And again, it's been such a useful tool for me. And I've pointed many a player in the direction of that as well, because they all want to see pictures of themselves, frankly, don't they? Right? And
Thank you.
it's
Thank
just
you.
it's just it is just like a, the it's this historic thing that is just
It's
full of
brilliant.
useful
And
and useful information. And I just love it.
the
Absolutely love it.
website, of course, it isn't just programs. There's handbooks in there as well. I've got
Listen,
pretty
there's even the
much
rent programs in there.
yep. I've got
Delighted at that.
yeah, I've got pretty much a full set of Albion fanzines, and they're certainly the full set of Gull's Eye, Scars and Stripes, Build a Bonfire, and lots more besides.
Fantastic. Many, many congratulations, Ian, and
Yes,
very good
Ian.
luck with the book.
Thank you very
Yeah, good
much.
luck,
It's been
mate.
my
You
pleasure.
deserve all the luck you get with it. It's a brilliant thing. But with that is all we have time for. So thank you so much to Ian Hine. Thank you to Alan Wes. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on our podcast, in association with Flowers Unlimited. Thanks for listening. We see you again next week. Bye.